me get to know ya. Hey, na, 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 delve into emotion, leave us in this moment. Yeah.
Hello, welcome to Literature License Podcast, and we're doing our Getting to Know You with John Wilson. Hello, John.
How are you? Hello.
Long time no talk.
I know. It feels weird being on the other side of the mic, so to speak. Usually we're the ones interviewing.
Being in the hot seat for once.
Yes, exactly.
So I thought we would start these interviews basically about a simple getting to know you. So who are you? What do you do for a living? Or what do you do in respect? Or more importantly, what do you want the people out there to know about you?
What I do for a living is sales and marketing. So I've been doing that for years now. I would say probably 20 something years of my life. But my joy is definitely doing things like this, doing the podcast that never would have imagined, you know, how many moons ago, 5-6 years ago, that I'd be doing something like this. Cause I've always loved art. So for me, I love writing. I love just being in arts, and I love, you know, at one point I was doing production and being a part of that, but anything to do with art and writing and is a joy for me. So my job is sales and marketing, but my joy is definitely doing things like this and playing video games. I love playing video games. That's how Keith and I met a long time ago, playing Friday the 13th. Little did we know, as we're trying to run from Jason, getting killed by Jason, that it would form a friendship, that, you know, he would offer this opportunity to me to be a part of the podcast, which has been such a joy in my life. Yeah,
imagine that must have been quite weird, coming off of, you know, 4 to 5 hours of Jason running after you. And I was like, can we have a conversation?
I know. Well, he was, you know, he had even said, he goes, you have this idea, and, you know, he had talked at that point, you had the literary agency, and you say everything that you were doing at the time, and working on scripts and working on books and reading reviews and like doing all this. And I was like, how the hell are you gonna have time to do this? But I was like, sure, count me on for this. And it's been such an amazing experience, you know, and trying to be a part of the craziness of all these podcasts and these conversations, which I don't think most of the viewers know how much work that actually goes into this. And in the beginning it was rough, which we both can say, like, in the beginning, yeah, it was like Planet of the Apes were like so by the book and everything. And as time went on, we just learned that we had to have fun with the conversations and enjoy each other's conversations. So
I think it took us until probably like the third or fourth episode where we started finding the rhythm and sort of thing. And then we figured out the wrong way to do an interview.
I know. And I think it's like, it's funny because like, I think it was Silence of the Lambs where we just kind of were like, oh, let's just have fun with this and go with it. And yeah, the interviews were always like interesting because we, as similar to this, there is a structure to them, but you do ultimately just have to flow with the person, and sometimes they don't flow and sometimes they do flow.
Well, I think what I learned, because you had a different experience than I did, but when I did Lawrence Hyman Jackson, Shirley Jackson's son, and he was kind of have the questions beforehand. And so I gave him the questions beforehand. So when we did that, when we were going through our interview, I was reading the questions and he was reading his answer. So it was just like this really odd interview.
Mine was, I gave him in advance too, but I felt like it was the reluctant answers, right? And so, you know, by the time I finished the interview, it was like a little frustrating, but, you know, you kind of make do with what you have, right? And I remember sending that to you, and we just kind of,
yours didn't even want to be there. It's like, what does happen?
It was a Christmas story, and I can't remember what his attachment to that was, but I remember
attachment to that. He had an attachment to Second City Comedy Clubs. He wrote
that's right. Yes. Yeah, and that was a part of the nuance of the story, because the story is written more as a comedy, and like it's different from the actual movie, which where the character's giving snippets of his life, and it's very comedic. So we talked about that, but the moment when we went into like talking about other things, it kind of always got pulled in. Well, this is what I do, and this one, and I'm like, great, now, but can we talk about the content, right? And it kind of kept being pulled back the other direction. So it's like, it's always an experience, you know.
I remember because they were just trying to get him to do like a Christmas, just to bring in a little bit of a Christmas story about his Christmases, just so we could tie it into the December.
Well, I think it was like, what was the most memorable gift, right? I think it was something like that. What was the most memorable gift? And he was like, I don't know, I don't really. And I was like, okay. And I'm like, you could have just said anything. You could have said, you know, a toy train, or, you know. But, you know.
Rosebud the sled. I mean, it was good enough for Citizen Kane. I'm sure it's good enough for you.
Exactly. Make it up.
Where's Isley? This is kind of like, you know, work with me here.
Yeah.
You know, but it's always like, promote your book, but we need to actually promote it so it actually fits in the confines of our episode.
And you learn, you know, what it's interesting is you learn every single step of the way. We've learned to evolve and go with the flow of people. And I think that was my first interview. And so I was a bit nervous because it was like, wow, I'm going to, you know, this is going to be something that's been on our site, and I want to do it right. And I want to do it, you know, and eventually you realize it's not about doing it right. It's actually having fun with what you're discussing and, you know, trying to nuance, you know, the questions sometimes, because now I think what I've learned from that is, okay, knowing that question wasn't answered the way I wanted it to, I could throw something in that pulls that interviewer to say something else or respond to something else, you know.
Always fine. A good compliment gives you a lot more content.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's also like, you know, sometimes it's breaking their nerves too. They're just as nervous as you. And so they never ever forget that as well. Like when someone comes to our show and they're, you know, for example, when we did Anna and the Apocalypse, I think they were all such great, but I think sometimes everyone's nervous. So we were using icebreakers in the beginning to kind of loosen people up and get people to start talking about their characters or whatever, right? And so we've learned, you know, from that point, you're going to, you know, loosen the ice a bit.
Yeah. Basically, just have your bullet points. That's better than left cover, and then everything else doesn't matter. Just as long as you keep the conversation afloat.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So, basically, of course, we are in the millennia, you know, 2021. And of course, everyone has a social media website presence. So how would you, if people wanted to keep in touch with you, how would they reach you? Which would you prefer?
You know, what's funny. I am on social. I am on Facebook, you know, John Wilson, on Instagram, John Wilson 76. I'm trying to actually create my own sort of channel or website, if you will, and kind of put my own content, because we've talked about this before. I do write, and I have written a lot of things. I haven't published anything, and I think I just want to get my toes a little wet by creating my own website. So eventually, you know, you can follow me there on Instagram at John Wilson 76, or you can follow me on Facebook at John Wilson. But you know, eventually on there you'll notice something probably popping up. I'm thinking about Wilson J, because there's so many John Wilsons in the world. There's a ridiculous amount of John Wilsons in the world, so I'm trying to come up with something that's unique that people can find me and read, you know. And a lot of them are going to be like life experience, but also just stuff that I've written and stuff that I'm co-working with too, because as I was telling Keith as well, I definitely want to start to work with other people and work on their projects. That is a passionate project for me as well, is to be able to help people kind of get their own things produced or get their own things written, and, you know, help people get their legs, you know, standing.
Now, we deal with a lot of different genres. What's your favorite genre?
Obviously for me, we explore everything, most of it is horror, sci-fi. If I can get a combo of the two, that's amazing, because I've always, even, you know, listening to other podcasts or watching films or reading content, I've always been gravitated towards the sci-fi, you know, Stranger from Another Planet. You know, I definitely feel like as a kid, like these types of things influence me and how I view things. Is always like the what if, you know. It's, you can watch a drama or comedy, it's kind of formulaic. So in some ways you get to the point where you watch a romance, you know, and you're like, oh, you know what's going to happen. This person's going to do that. That's going to do that. That's going to, it's, so it's all predictable, and I don't like predictability. So when I watch something like Midsommar, which we reviewed, like that, it's shocking, but at the same time, it's not, it's hard to predict. And I love things like that, that just always keep me on my toes. So I love, that's why I love our podcast so much, because we do review a lot of that. Every once in a while, we'll do like musicals and things like that. But I typically am drawn to horror and sci-fi. Yeah.
And what is your favorite film?
Oh, this is such an impossible, when I saw this question, I was like, this is such an impossible, possible answer, because I love film. I love, you know, all aspects of film, like noir, you know, and different areas of, we were literally just this past weekend, we were talking about Madeline Kahn and just the movie she was in, and I, you know, Clue, and, you know, what are Blazing Saddles? We were talking about all these different films, and it's so hard, because you go, oh, well, this influenced me, right? So as a kid watching Friday the 13th for the first time as a teenager, like that was my first horror, I think, film. No, actually, I take that back. Nightmare on Elm Street was my first horror. But you're always influenced by different films, so it's hard to just go, this is my favorite. It's like trying to pick your favorite child, which I know people do, but it's literally so hard, because, you know, my, which I'll talk about a little bit later, like, you know, my mom and I have experiences with films, and my friends have experiences with films. You and I, Keith, have experience because of what we do. I think that's an amazing thing about films and storytelling, is that you just get pulled into films, and I get the joy of being able to talk about them all the time. So I can't pick a favorite. I'm sorry.
No, I did Scapegoat. I picked four. I got four favorite films, that my four go-to films. So, and none of them are horror. Go figure.
That is strange. Yeah. I mean, I could say, if I would say that the ones that I repeat, I definitely say I love watching, which most people don't know, Foul Play. So I remember as a kid, my mom and dad.
I love Foul Play. Goldie Hawn and Chevy Chase.
So good. It's like a murder mystery, comedy, dramedy. It's really funny. And most people don't know it, because it was like Goldie Hawn in her, what, 30s? 20s?
Yeah. I just know that I want to drive on that highway and listen to Barry Manilow sing Ready to Take a Chance Again.
Yeah. Ready to take. I mean, even Beware of the Dwarf. Like, there's just, I mean, it's so good. So that was definitely.
We're just Meredith as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Penguin. I always remember because the Penguin's in that.
And so that one I tend to put on replay. So, and even my friends are like, oh, we've never seen it. I said, okay, well, that's one we're putting on our list of we have to see this. Like this, you know. Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me that. That's actually one I have to go out and buy. Actually, I love that film. I watched that. That was on HBO in the early days. And I was staying with my dad, and I was watching it on repeat. Every time it came on, I watched it. And God, I forgot about that film. Foul Play. And I don't like Chevy Chase, but I like him in that.
And I love the chemistry that they have in it, too. It's really, I mean, it's just a great film. And then just the cast of characters and that are in it, that you can't help but laugh, and the suspense by it, you know, it's really fun. It's a fun film.
Maybe in season 6, we'll do a San Francisco comedy night where we'll do Foul Play and What's Up Doc.
Oh my God. I love What's Up Doc. That's another one. That's a great one too. Yeah.
Brilliant. So what is your earliest film memory?
So in line with what I was talking about with my mom, Lead Her to Heaven. So that film, God, I had to be probably maybe 11 or 12. It did two things for me when I watched this film. It was one that was like, my mom would not watch the typical black and white films. Like, she would watch like dark, mysterious, like, you know, films. And it was like, you know, for instance, with that one, it is a story about a woman who, you know, frames her sister for her murder. And I just remember watching it going, what am I watching? And I was like so intrigued by this, because most typical black and white was, you know, Breakfast at Tiffany's or, you know, like those types of films. My mom was like all about Eve and Whatever Happened to Baby Jane and like some of those films. Like, she loved the macabre, you know. And the second thing I would say is like, it wasn't about the happily ever after, which I think most films always, everyone had a happy ending. So that film, it kind of has a happy ending, but it just went, as you watch it, you go, wow, it's really messed up. Like from, and as a kid, you know, I was used to, you know, films where everyone gets their joy at the end. And this was not that. Like it kind of is like a mess, really messed up ending. And it was, it just affected me that way. It was just like one of those films that was like, wow, not everything has to be a happy ending. And I like that. And I like that, you know, we don't have to have everything wrapped up in a nice little package, you know?
Do you ever notice that the films that do not have that happy ending are the ones that pretty much stay ingrained in your subconscious forevermore?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Like for instance, it's blinking on me. Where the woman becomes an addict and she's on a game show.
Requiem for a Dream.
Yeah, like that movie was one that just got like burned into my brain. And same with Blue Valentine. Oh my God. It that is the most depressing film. I walked out going, I think I need to go watch something or I need to pet a puppy because this is just, it was like, just leaves you in a pit, you know?
Well, it's even like those two films, the you know, what I call the Betty Davis double bill, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane and Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
They don't have good endings at all. I mean, the other, you know, her sister's dying and her last words is like, I mean, we could have been friends. It's like, bum, 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 and Hush, Hush, Sweet Charlotte. Yeah. It's like, you know, she's this tormented woman and she gets carted off at the end. And it's just like, you know, none of it was her fault. It's all, you know, bitch, Livia de Havilland's fault.
Yeah.
So you're left like watching this film going, oh my God. It's like, you know, but those, you know, those kind of films stay with me as well.
So. Yeah. I mean, if you think about when we watch like Midsommar and things like that, those were not like, wow, so happy that, you know, it's perspective, right? And you get to kind of see a different perspective of what it would be if, you know, someone kind of finds their joy in an occult and then, or, you know, like the fact that this whole family gets eradicated by a bigger force than them, you know, when it comes to, what was the other one? Not Midsommar, but
Hereditary,
you know, like that was another one that you just are left a little bit dark inside. You're like, wow. You know, what did I just watch? But you'll never forget it. You'll never forget the scenes and how it played out, you know, those types of stories.
But then again, I guess with horror, is there really ever a happy ending with horror? Ever? You think about it?
I mean, if you talk about like the ones with the final girls, because those are typical, right? Like, you know, someone's going to survive and it's usually the one that's a little bit smarter than everyone else, a little bit more cautious than everyone else. But like, yeah, for the most part, most horrors, as soon as it ends, it's followed up by a scene where the killer's still alive, still persevering. They're going to come back for you, you know, so you survive for now, right? And so there's that, you know.
But even if the final girl survives and the killer is dead, her life's never going to be the same, is it?
Oh, yeah. No, never.
She'll be haunted for the rest of her life.
And always, like, always looking over your shoulder, right? Because, you know, and we're never even probably investing in friendships because most of them got murdered, you know? And you're like, how do you survive that, you know, those types of
things? I'm never going to have sex or do drugs ever again. That's what I'm going to save me.
Exactly. Yeah. Or they just become a nun. The next film, they're a nun. They're like, screw it.
Well, you know, finding a relationship's hard when you're normal. I mean, you know, I don't know if you're a basket case, it must be even worse for the person.
I know. Oh my God.
So what is your favorite book or author?
You know this. I think I've talked about this. I love Stephen King. I do love him. Like he definitely influenced me wanting to write. The book The Talisman was sort of, I think, something I read when I was 11 or 12. I just love like the story of a young boy going on this journey and flipping between worlds. So it's a mix of horror and sci-fi in that aspect, that Jack is trying to save his mother who's dying, but then he's also flipping between worlds where the other version of his mother is a queen and she's being, basically her throne is trying to be taken from her by his uncle. So it's a very interesting story. And I just remember going, wow, it like opened my mind to other worlds. And, you know, Stephen King, just after that, just a lot of the books, Carrie and Pet Sematary and Misery and The Shining, all of these books, like, just influenced me a lot and how I kind of viewed horror, you know, because horror, it's very, like, people think about horror, like, my dad would probably never watch a horror film, but there's such another layer of nuance to horror that people just don't see, and it's, you know, often the family dynamic, it's the relationships of, you know, that people deal with hardships, whether it's divorce, or it's drugs, or it's addiction, or it's, you know, abusive father, like, those types of things, like, it's something that's always weaved throughout his books, and the complex relationships sort of take stage over the horror sometimes. And I love that, because you kind of, you know, The Shining is a perfect example of that, how he's trying to be the best father he can, but he's always in the back of him is always has this addiction coming at him. And eventually that the Overlook preys on that, and it preys on, you know, that addiction. And I love Stephen King. He's fantastic.
Speaking of The Talisman, did you actually read Black House, the sequel to it as well?
I actually have the audiobook, which I think I, the first probably two or three chapters I started to listen to, and I actually have to go back to it, because my friend was saying you should definitely, you know, read or listen to that, because he said it was really good.
Yeah, I tried to get into it. I think I love Talisman, but I think because there's such a huge break between the two books,
yeah,
I think I'm going to have to read The Talisman and read Black House again, sort of thing.
I think that's what I need to do, because I the one thing I would say, like, the difference between most of his books is this is co-authored, and it's a little bit at the beginning of the Black House, an exposition of the land and the space that you're in, and sometimes that I am turned off by it. Just tell me where I'm at. Like, I don't need to know every nuance, every house, every block, the first few chapters is all this little town and this bar and this, and then this person. And you're trying to figure out, like, why do I need to know all this? And then eventually you get into a little bit as to why, because you're trying to understand the dynamics of the town, but that can be a little bit off-putting. And so I feel like I do need to go back.
I think that's the Peter Strub side of it, because we're going to be covering Ghost Story this season.
Okay.
And of course, we're covering The Dead Zone next week, actually. We're doing Dead Zone, the book and the film. But so it's going to be quite interesting, because what you just said, I think that must be the Peter Strub, because I remember trying to read Ghost Story. I haven't actually read the book. I'll be reading it in 2 months' time. But I know that whenever I started it, there was these long passages of time and place, and gave you a lot of information. So I'm kind of wondering if that must be, and now they've just finished The Dark Zone, and Stephen King's very, very precise with his, Stephen King is always reminds me of your grandfather on a rocking chair on the porch, and he's going to tell you a story, and he follows me into this story sort of thing. And it's all about characterizations, and it's all about the way they talk to each other, but it's very, very little about the place and the way the place is set out. We don't get a long passages like this is the house and sitting on the middle, you know, and all the grass and what all that kind of stuff.
And the first one, it works, but because you are going East Coast to West Coast, so it is important. And then you're flipping between worlds, right? So it is important to understand where things sit, because when Jack does travel in minutes, it's hours, I think, if I remember the way it works. So it's important for you to, like, imagine going on a road trip. You can kind of scale in how long it's going to take him to get all the way to the West Coast by when he flips over. But in this, it's more, it's exposition as to why the town is the way it is. And it's around a serial killer who's killing people, but it gets a little bit too much into that in the beginning. And it was a little off-putting, because by the time you actually get to dialogue, you're kind of like, what was all that for? Like, why did I need to know all this? You know, like, the Cubs won, and you're like, okay, why? Like, what the, you know, like, you get a little bit like, why, you know? But I definitely think, King only uses it if it's necessary, meaning Overlook. You give a very detailed review of it, because the Overlook is an actual character, right? And so you have to build out the immensity and the gravity of its, like, sinking well. And he does a fantastic job with that. Christine is a car, but it is a character, right? So unless it's like a place is a character, then you're going to kind of do that. Because imagine if he did that with The Stand. Oh my God, you would shoot yourself. Because The Stand is a lot of this character, then here they're here and then that. But imagine each time going back to the character and describing everything, where the character's at, why they're there, like, you know. And it's like, okay, but now you're giving, the street looks like this, this building looks like that, and you're like, okay, now I would shoot myself, you know.
Yeah, see, I think that after spending a whole year reading, doing the classic novels, that I'll probably be ready for Ghost Story now, because I've learned to go through a lot of pointless narrative
or description, right? Narrative is one thing, but like description, and just it's like describe. And it's funny going through writing classes, and there are some professors that wanted me to do that, and there are other professors like less is more, right? So you know don't tell me, show me, right? It's that sort of mentality of, you don't need to give the sweeping views unless there's a reason for that, right? Like, let's just stay focused on the character. Imagine the cameras moving in on those characters. They don't need to see the whole purview of the land. They just need to focus there. Other writers would say different, right? No, I need to know what shore they're on, where they're standing, what time of day is it, what is the water, what does the ocean feel like, you know, how cold is it? And you're like, why do I find, you know, and you get a little bit like frustrated, but that's how you're taught sometimes too. So I also give a little bit of room for that, because it is sort of, that's the style. And some people love that. Some people want to know exactly what that scene looks and feels like so they can be in that scene. I don't need as much. I'm pretty much, you could say one thing, you know, like one of his stories starts off with is a diary entry where it is a short story about a man who kills his wife. And it's very, you know, anyone who reads this day, I killed my wife. That to me, it was like, I don't even know what the farm looks like. I don't need to know what anything else looks like. That is like, you got me, you pulled me in, you know? Mm-hmm.
Well, I know about, you know, over-descriptiveness. I did do Moby Dick this time, where we had 120 pages of what it means to whale, what whaling is, what kind of ship it is, what kind of harpoon, you know, how many centimeters the point is.
Yeah. I think it's also a different style of writing for that time, right? Because we've read a few books that were like that too. I'm trying to remember one of the other ones we read that was similar.
Turning the Screw.
Turning the Screw is like that. Yeah. Turning the Screw is because you're, again, trying to paint a picture of the landscape of what this property is and where everyone is. And it was like a lot of, okay, can we just get, can we get to where they're at right now? And, you know, what's going on and why this is happening, you know?
Well, I think like before the advent of television and documentaries and the world that we're living in now, I can understand why you would need that, because you need to, people weren't familiar what was going on beyond their own village. But I think nowadays, I think everyone's pretty much aware. I mean, I could sit there and go, you know, say something like, Johannesburg, you know, South Africa. And I probably don't need to go into a lot of detail now, because most people already have an idea. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
We're back in the day, it makes a lot more sense, because, you know, you didn't know, you know, you had no idea. So you need this long descriptive.
Well, text. And it's also like creating a symbol, is creating a semblance of social dynamics too. So if you have, like, for instance, someone in their home, they have all these trinkets, right? And there's all these things. And the more you create you paint the canvas of opulence, right? So you now know this is a very well-to-do family. Whereas now you could say, oh, this family lives in the Hamptons. You're like, okay, you know, opulence, right? And you could even say geographically, East Hamptons, West Hamptons, right? And you would know, okay, you know what type of, how, what their stature is in their living. But back then you would have to create how poor someone was or how rich someone was, because that was part of the dynamics of the story too. The young pauper falls for the prince, right? And then, so you have to show the level of the dynamics, you know?
Totally agree. So season 5 is coming on to us very, very quickly. What episode are you looking more forward to?
I'm actually looking forward to the entire season, because, you know, as you know, Keith always gives us the lineup of everything. I'm definitely going to be the part of the 2-for-1s. I've seen some of these films. I haven't seen a lot of these films. I'm actually looking forward to dipping my toes into, you know, the 80s horror completely, because I think I was more 90s current horror. And like, as I was going through a list, like Scanners, Night of the Demons, The Fog, The Uninvited, like all those I've seen, but there's a lot of them I have not seen. So I get excited for that, because you could re-review something and it might even change your perception of when you first viewed it. And we've talked about that before, how much you love a film. And then sometimes when you watch it now, you're like, oh, it seems a little hokey now. You know, when you first watch it, you're like, oh, this is amazing. So a lot of these are going to be my first watch. So I can't wait to kind of, like I said, expand myself on some of these films that I haven't seen, you know?
The only one I'm dreading is Videodrome.
So. Videodrome. Who picked that? You?
Yeah, I did. I mean, I put the 80s list together sort of thing. It was very difficult to do the 80s list because we got some stuff that we're planning for doing it with the podcast as far as like franchises and episodes around those and seasons, you know, later seasons. So I had to find stuff that was not part of franchises whatsoever. And because of David Cronenberg doing Dead Zone, I figured, well, we might as well cover two Cronenberg films.
So, oh, so we're doing that with standards,
I've seen
right?
Videodrome, but it disturbs me. It makes me feel ill and queasy and disturbs me.
So oh, great. Yay. Yeah, yeah. And the, well, I'll put this on my list of Rec Room for a Dream. Like, I probably will never watch that film again for that same reason. It just made me, like, disturbed. It just hit me the wrong way.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how it affects me. Because when I saw it at the movie theater, I felt sick. I just, you know, I couldn't bear to watch it again. But I thought, well, let's put it on the list. Force myself to watch it and see how I feel from a teenager looking at it now as a middle-aged adult.
Well, I mean, also, I think now, because we've seen so many other things that, I forget what film we watched that I think normally if I would have saw it, that maybe it's Toxic, just the way that the effects of, you know, I'm not much for gore. I just don't like gore that much. I'm not a gore person by any means, but after have seen some other films like Saw and like these torture porn, like, you know, Hostel and all this, like after that, you become a little desensitized to things. So when you go back to watch something you thought was so graphic and gruesome, you're like, oh, that wasn't that bad. You're like, oh, that's good now. You're good, you know?
Yeah. I mean, imagine, you know, also when you're watching stuff for the podcast, as you know, is that you kind of watch it. It's different than just watching a film. You're kind of watching it and you're actually studying it at the same time. So you start it because you know you're going to be talking about it. It's kind of odd.
Yeah.
So what do you like about podcasting now that you've been doing it going into your fifth year?
You know, it's funny. In the beginning, I was so nervous because it was about trying to do it right. And like going back to Planet of the Apes, I was so nervous because I just didn't want to sound like a complete idiot. And I think what I love about the podcast is our spontaneity and how we are, though we have a formula and we always have a run of show, if you will, we hardly ever, I mean, we don't now at this point, we don't really follow it. I know you do because Keith has to, because of timing perspective, has to look at, oh yeah, I hit all the marks or where we put, you know, certain things inside the podcast that he has to later edit on. But I love that we kind of flow off of each other. And it is the level of when we talk about certain things, our perceptions, right? How we perceive things versus how, you know, how I perceive versus you versus Vicky or whoever, right? It gives me a new view that I wouldn't have thought about, right? And so there are times when we discuss things, I'm like, oh, and I'll go back and after the podcast and I'll ponder on that a little bit and like maybe rewatch something and go, I did not see that, or I did not. Mm-hmm. So I love that aspect of it. And I love that we're able to kind of share that with our audience because it just allows us to kind of have fun with it. Right. And that's the point of all this, is really just to kind of get people to kind of see different perspectives on a film and get people to be interested in films and watch them. You know, this is a couple of two things that I love, which is literature and film. And, you know, those, there's a lot of people out there that either like one or the other or both. Right. And, it definitely is. We sometimes go sideways in the conversation, but we always come back to where we need to be because we end up, that's how fun we end up having, you know? Mm-hmm.
And do you have a favorite quote or saying?
For the longest time, I used to always live by, live, laugh, or love. You know, it was just something my mom would always say, like when things get tough, things get hard, ultimately it's just, you know, just going out, having fun, living life, enjoying life, loving the things that you love. And you don't have to just love one thing. You can love many things. But lately it's been oddly and interesting, similarly entwined with the word love. It was on WandaVision. but what is grief but love enduring? And I just think that's such an amazing thing. This last year and a half has been very difficult for a lot of people, and people, a lot of people have suffered loss. But knowing that, and knowing that grief is just love enduring, is such a beautiful thing. And I actually said that to my dad, my papa, when I went to go see him, that, you know, the love that you feel towards your wife who's no longer with you, it's just love enduring, you know, and that's a very powerful thing when you think about it.
And do you have any special message for our fans about anything that's changed your life?
You know, it wasn't, I don't think I really received many messages. I think the one time Vicky had mentioned someone saying they miss me. And that was like, it was an amazing thing to feel that someone A, hears me or knows, you know, I'm a part of this. And B, it was like, it was really hard because I think in the first two seasons, I was always very present as much as I possibly could be. And then one point, you know, season three, I had to like talk to Keith and say, you know, I have some personal things going on and with my family, and I have, you know, just life choices that I had to make. And I had to kind of take a step back and reevaluate the time I was putting into things, because it was very difficult with work and trying to always be present here and not in other aspects of my life. And it was difficult, but it was also lovely to hear that people miss me, you know, and like that was, it was nice to hear that, you know, from a fan. And I always try to be present. And as Keith knows, like it is a juggle. And I tell everyone, have balance in your life. I don't know how Keith does half the things he does, because he is always juggling 15 balls up in the air. Like he's literally just tossing and going. But always try to have balance in your life. Always try to give yourself the space that you need in order to function, and function at a point where you love what you do. And that's what I wanted to make sure that was, you know, important for me, was I didn't want to walk away completely from this because I do love doing this. I just had to take a little bit of a sidestep a bit to give myself some of that time to do other things that were important to me. So, you know, again, yeah, it's creating balance, finding balance, and, you know, thanking the listeners for being here and for showing up, and to please give us more feedback. Please give us more comments on what you want to hear, what, you know, what works and what doesn't for you. But, you know, definitely we love hearing from you.
And when your time has passed on this blue marble that we're spinning around on, what do you want to best be remembered for?
Oh, we're all going to die together tomorrow. There's a big asteroid that's coming out from outer space. It's just going to blow us.
I'm about to sign my arms open, ready to catch it.
I know, exactly. I remember a professor of mine would say, if the world was ever ending, this is a sci-fi class, if the world was ever ending, I'd give me a bottle of whiskey and a woman, and anyone who had seen whatever they're going to see on that street, you can either stay or go. I just laughed at him, but it was like, you know, So what I would say is I would want people to remember, you know, that we all get forgotten at a point in time, you know, that ultimately as we pass, you know, graves stay there and generations go after generations, and we do get forgotten. And that is just a part of life. Right. So it is important to live now, to live as you are now, break down the walls that you build up for yourself, and enjoy what you do. This podcast has been a gift. Never would I have ever thought I would have been a part of this. And it's just been such a gift to be a part of something like this and just to live, you know. Life is too short. It goes by so quickly. You know, I'm now 45, and it's sort of like seeing my dad, who's now 82. It's like, wow, it just, time just kind of moves. So, you know, just enjoy, live, you know.
And the Steve Miller Band said, time keeps on ticking.
Yeah, just things keep going, you know. you never want to believe that you're, you know, oh my God, I'm going to be remembered. I'm going to be, you know, I think most people who are remembered are more people who were infamous than they are famous. Mm-hmm. So people who died of overdoses, or who died of being really cruel or mean people, they get remembered throughout history. But like the people who actually do good things, kind things, we're always there for the people they love. All those people end up dying eventually, and they just disappeared, you know. And I think it's, you know, again, it's just important to kind of live each day as they are, you know.
Well, I think Lion King said it best. They live in you.
True. They live and die in you. No,
well, this brings us to the end of the Get If You Know You section. You can listen to John Wilson do our 2-for-1, which is the 80s for season 5, which will start in September. And our first 80s will be Scanners from 1981 and Videodrome from 1983, where I'll probably be queasy and sick.
I can't wait. I'll fuck it for you.
And we'll see y'all. Thank you. Thanks again, John.
Bye. Thank you, guys.
Leave us in this moment.